Welcome to Radioactive Theater, a production of Audio Journal, presenting quality dramas for our listening audience. For this program, we present two selections from The Twilight Zone, popular plays for radio, TV, and film, created by Rod Serling. In 2013, TV Guide ranked it number 4 in its list of the 60 greatest dramas of all time. Our first selection is A Piano in the House by Earl Hamner, featuring John Riccio, John Gorman, Bob McCracken, Katie Traver, Gary Galanik, and Lorraine Mason.
Hello. Is anyone there? Hello? Is anyone there? Well, how do you do? I'm Fitzgerald Fortune, the theater critic.
So what?
Isn't rudeness something of a handicap in your line of work?
What's that to you?
When I saw the name Treasures Unlimited, I stepped through that door fully expecting to encounter some sentimental old biddy in an ostrich-plumed hat and a moth-eaten feather boa. Instead, to my sincere delight, I seem to have discovered a misanthrope.
What's that?
A man who despises people.
I got work to do, mister. What are you looking for?
I'm looking for a present for my wife's birthday.
Wrong place. Junk shop.
Exactly. You see, my wife has the absurd notion that she would like to learn to play the piano. Unfortunately, she hasn't a trace of talent. So, do you happen to have one of those old pianos that plays itself?
Got one. Don't know if it works or not. It's old.
Splendid. Would you mind showing it to me, please?
You're taking a lot of my time, mister.
And you're taking an equal amount of mine.
Make for your wife?
The 26th.
So young. You must be a man of great personal magnetism to attract such a wife so young.
I am.
Utterly romantic. Youth and wisdom, hand in hand. How I'd love to see it, two of you together. What a picture you must make. And for her birthday, you're giving her the gift of music. How touching.
What is the price of the piano?
You're taking your young bride out somewhere tonight. Some quiet nook where you can be lost together in the midst of the great world, looking into each other's eyes.
How much for the piano?
It's worth $250, but since it's for a birthday present, I'll let you have it for $200.
I shall expect delivery before 6 o'clock this evening. The address is right here, on my check.
Certainly. I shouldn't like to have this little lady disappointed on her birthday.
Has it occurred to you that you're extraordinarily susceptible to the power of music?
Isn't everybody?
Well, to some degree, yes.
Are you going to stand around all day taking my good time?
No, I was just going.
Well, there's the door.
Tell me, are you sentimental about anything else besides birthdays?
Birthdays? They're a stupid waste of time and money.
Extraordinary.
Mr. Fitzgerald Fortune, theater critic and cynic at large, on his way to a birthday party. If he knew what was in store for him, he probably wouldn't go. Because before this evening is over, that cranky old piano is going to play those piano roll blues with some effects that could happen only in the Twilight Zone.
Good evening, sir.
You've dusted the piano, I see.
Yes, sir. It came an hour ago, sir.
Oh, Marvin.
Yes, sir.
If you're going to serve at the party tonight, do you think you could manage to do something about your face?
My face, sir?
A party is supposed to be a happy occasion. Do you think you can manage to be a little less miserable than usual?
I will do my best, sir.
Is that you, Gerald?
Yes, Esther.
Hello, darling.
Esther, I want you to let Marvin go.
What has he done?
No, it's not anything that he's done. It's just the way he looks. I hate coming home every day to be confronted with that lugubrious expression of his. It's unspeakably depressing. Look at him. He looks like he's going to burst into tears at any moment. Surely, at least we can have a servant who's cheerful to have around.
There's no need to hurt his feelings, dear.
He has no feelings. The man's a clod. Well, you don't like the piano, I take it.
Oh, I love the piano. I really do.
Have you played it?
I didn't know how it worked, so I thought I'd wait until you came home.
You see, I remembered that you wanted to learn to play the piano.
Yes, but the piano plays itself.
Yes. Wasn't that considerate of me? See, I didn't want you to take all those tedious lessons and then find out in the end of it all that you really had no musical talent at all.
Oh, I see.
Well, darling, no thanks for my birthday present? No emotion of any kind?
Yes. Thank you, Gerald.
Well, now, let's hear what this one sounds like. It has a happy enough sounding title.
Oh, a cocktail for you, Miss Esther.
Thank you, Marvin.
Marvin, what on earth is the matter with you?
Are you feeling all right, Marvin?
I'm very well, thank you, madam.
But you're smiling.
Oh, am I?
You most certainly are.
Well, that's probably because I'm happy, sir.
What are you happy about?
Oh, everything. I make good money, I got a nice place to live, my health, money in the bank, I like my job.
But you couldn't possibly. I treat you atrociously.
Oh, you don't bother me, Mr. Fortune. You tickle me. Sometimes it's all I can do to keep from laughing out loud when you have one of your tantrums. Oh, I get a great kick of it when you go around flecking the furniture to see if I've dusted or checking the silver to see if it's polished. I'm sorry if I spoke out of place, sir.
Oh, no. On the contrary, Marvin. I'm very glad you did. You may go. Thank you.
What a strange thing to happen.
Who would have thought that beneath that gloomy exterior, the man was concealing a sunny nature? Of course, I've always believed that we have two faces, one that we wear and the other that we keep hidden. The problem has always been to find some method to make people reveal their hidden faces. I suppose it helps if you know what particular hidden face you're looking for. How do you like this music, Esther?
You beast. I've controlled myself for 6 years, and I can't stand it any longer. I was a stupid child when I married you. I thought you were a great man, but you aren't. You're a sadistic fiend. You take pleasure in humiliating me in front of your clever friends. You enjoy hurting me. I've stood your cruelty for 6 years, and I cannot stand it anymore.
Are you feeling well, my dear?
Oh, I've never felt better in years. It's a great relief to tell you what I really think of you. I've kept it bottled up for so long. I thought you needed me. I thought you needed my love, but you don't. You just need someone to bully and to torture when you feel like it. I tried to love you. Heavens knows I did. But I hate you. I hate you.
Congratulations, my dear. Magnificent performance. If you'd been on stage, Esther, I should have given you superlative reviews.
Oh, I don't know what possessed me.
Well, I do. I seem to have bought you a more interesting birthday present than I thought. I wonder what other people are hiding.
Oh, Gerald, promise me that you won't play the piano again at the party tonight.
I promise no such thing. I wasn't looking forward to this party very much, But now, I think we're going to have a most amusing evening.
Good evening, Marvin.
Good evening, sir.
Jerry.
Greg, good to see you. Scotch?
Of course. You're unusually cordial tonight. That is your smile you're wearing, isn't it?
I took it out of cold storage in honor of Esther's birthday.
Well, not I. I don't plan to smile all evening.
I'm glad to see you share my distaste for birthdays.
Well, birthdays, anniversaries, and certain holidays I overlook whenever possible. They seem to imply a certain sticky human involvement, which I'd much rather avoid.
Oh, is that true? I've always gathered you were something of a ladies' man, rather thickly involved.
You've been misinformed, Jerry, my boy. I'm much too selfish to fall in love.
And you're miserable?
Not in the least. I value the peace and quiet of my orderly bachelor existence. It lets me write my plays without interference from anyone.
Oh, yes. How is the new play?
Brilliant. By the way, where's the birthday girl?
Oh, she's still at her makeup table. Her emotions were showing, and she's covering up a little. Tell me, what do you think of this amusing little toy I found her?
Why, I haven't seen one of those old jobs in years. It doesn't play, does it?
It does indeed. It plays remarkably well. Let me show you. I have a piece especially for you. Romantic, wouldn't you say?
No, is Esther pleased with it?
She hasn't shown any great enthusiasm.
That doesn't sound like Esther. Usually she's so grateful for any small show of affection. I think that's one of her most lovable qualities, the ability to accept a bouquet of daisies as though they were the rarest of orchids. I remember once I gave her a small ring, a turquoise ring. She accepted as if it was the Hope Diamond.
Oh, I remember when she brought that ring back from Mexico City, but I seem to recall that she went there alone.
Yeah, yes, she did. We ran into each other down there.
She never mentioned it. Wasn't that rather an odd coincidence?
Jerry, has it ever occurred to you that I'm very deeply in love with your wife?
My dear Greg, I always believed that you were about as capable of passion as a head of lettuce. And Esther's emotional power was that of a newborn kitten.
Now, don't speak of her that way.
I'll speak of her any way I please. She's my wife.
You don't know Esther at all. Esther is full of love. Her skin is warm and soft like velvet. The scent of her hair is enough to drive a man wild. Her hands are gentle, sweet to kiss and to hold. Esther is music, honey. Esther is...
Jerry, no!
Oh, I'm sorry you did that, my dear. I don't know when I've been so highly entertained.
Esther, I'm sorry. I can't explain what happened.
It's probably just as well. I've never enjoyed deceiving you, Gerald.
My dear, you are incapable of deceiving me. I've known for years of your capacity for doing any number of sordid little things. The only revelation that's been made to me is the specific details of your squalid little affair. Ah, our guests are arriving. Before I welcome them, I wish you a happy birthday, my dear, and hope that the next 26 years will be equally rewarding.
Gerald, please don't use the piano again tonight. It's not something that you fool with.
I'm not fooling with it, my dear. I'm using it with deadly accuracy.
Hi, Marvin.
Good evening, Miss Moore.
Marge, my dear, do come in.
Well, don't just stand there devouring me with your eyes. Kiss me, you fool.
Marge, I'm really vexed with you. You promised me the last time I saw you, you'd be as svelte as an antelope.
I've been on more diets than Arcaro has been on horses. But somehow I always manage to get thrown before the finish line. Happy birthday, Esther.
Thank you, Marge.
I'm not even speaking to you, Gregory. Do you realize it's been months since you've called me? Somebody else been taking my place?
As a matter of fact, yes. We've just been having an illuminating discussion about Greg's new romance.
Well, don't tell me her name, or I just might scratch her eyes out. Or worse yet, I might just sit on her and mash her to death. Well, isn't somebody going to offer me a drink?
Oh, you'll have to talk to Marvin. I believe another stagecoach has arrived. Darling, you look ravishing. How are you? Ross, good to see you. Hello, Mary.
Happy birthday, Esther.
Oh, this looks marvelous. Why don't you have one?
Not with my diet.
Diet? What's that?
All right, everyone. May I have your attention, please? Now, would you just find seats? Anywhere, on the floor will be fine.
Not me. I'd never be able to get up.
The time has come for fun and games. Now, being mostly friends of Esther's, you're probably inclined to such intellectual pursuits as spin the bottle or pin the tail on the donkey. However, tonight, I thought rather than cater to your juvenile mentalities, we might perhaps have a rather more adult game.
When are we going to cut the cake? I'm hungry.
Compulsive eaters will find hors d'oeuvres within arm's reach. Now, for this game, we shall need a volunteer. Well, in the absence of a volunteer, I shall have to conscript someone. Marge Moore.
Me? Okay, Svengali, what's the caper?
All I want you to do is listen to some music, my dear.
I can do that.
Talk to me, Marge. Tell me what you're feeling.
My name isn't Marge.
What is your name?
My name is Tina.
Who are you, Tina?
I'm a little girl.
And what do you like to do?
Oh, I love to dance.
All right, Tina. Dance for us. Shh, shh. All right. You may stop dancing now, Tina. Tell me, are you always Tina?
Not always.
What else are you, Marge?
Sometimes I pretend that I'm a snowflake. White and tiny and perfectly formed, I float on the air of pale blue, moonlit night. I'm never lonely. I'm beautiful and slender. Oh, and I'm loved. I see a man with his hand stretched out. I drift down and reach that hand. I'm enclosed by his warmth, and I melt with his love.
It was all in fun, my dear. I chose you especially because I thought you'd enjoy a joke.
Oh, Gerald, don't you think that we've had enough of that piano for tonight?
Not quite. Sit down, everybody. I'm going to call forth the devil. I hardly think we should get a volunteer, but that doesn't matter. Esther, put this on the piano. And cheer up, darling. It's only a game.
Of course. I think I might take this one instead.
Now, this is going to be Faust. If there really is a devil among us, we shall know it soon enough.
It looks like it's you, Jerry. Say something, devil.
I'm afraid.
What are you afraid of, devil?
I'm afraid of the dark.
Why? You're not a devil. You're just a poor, frightened kid.
That's a secret.
Tell us your secret, Jerry.
I'm afraid of you all. I'm afraid of people. There's a small, frightened boy, and I've kept him hidden away inside me. And he only likes to hurt people, and I can't stop him from doing it. Did you know that I envied you, Marge? I can't embrace the world as you do. And in my envy, I released that frightened child inside me, and I let him hurt you. I tried to hurt you too, Greg. I gave bad reviews to your plays when I should have given praise. I coveted your talent because I have none. And I hurt you in every childish way I could.
I think we'd better go.
Esther, I've hurt you most of all. You came to me with love, but it frightened me. I don't know how to return love, except as a child does, with shrieks and blows and indifference.
Good night, Esther. Wait. Esther, will you come with me?
Yes, Gregory. I'll come with you.
Where are you all going? I don't want you to leave. Come back. If you leave me, I'm going to be very naughty.
Come
Yeah. Marvin, don't laugh at me.
I'm not laughing, Mr. Fortune. You're not funny anymore.
Mr. Fitzgerald Fortune, a man who went searching for concealed persons and found himself in the Twilight Zone.
Our next offering from the Twilight Zone is Stopover in a Quiet Town, also by Earl Hamner, featuring Gary Galanik as Bob Fraser, Katie Traver as Millie Fraser, Lorraine Mason as the little girl, and Catherine Thornton as her mother. Here we are back in the Twilight Zone.
Reveille, old tiger. The year's at spring. The spring's at morn. The morn's at seven.
Speak softly, woman. I've got a hangover that was meant for a much bigger man.
Want the ice bag?
No, just call an undertaker. What was in those martinis, anyway?
Gin. Held down wind from vermouth.
I wasn't, by any chance, the life of the party.
No, you were perfectly fine. You told that joke about the ball bearings.
Oh, no.
And you broke a lamp making a forward pass with a throw pillow.
Oh, my God.
And then you spent the rest of the evening ogling that girl with the low-cut sequin dress.
Well, she was pretty.
How would you know? You never looked at her face. I knew you were swack, but really?
What?
You slept in your clothes? I think that's disgusting. The least you could have done was to take off, I didn't have that much to drink either. Bob, where are we?
I hope we are in the bedroom of an apartment on West 12th Street, New York City.
Well, we are not.
I never saw this room before in my life. We went to sleep at home, didn't we?
Sure we did. Remember? We left the party up in Bedford Village. I drove because you were...
sleepy.
Let's just say you were unable to drive. We had the top down, and I thought it would revive you, and then somewhere above Riverdale...
Somewhere above Riverdale what?
Wait a minute. Something came down on the car from overhead... Like a shadow, and then... That's all I remember.
You probably plowed into another car.
I did not plow into another car.
Well, another car plowed into us. We probably got knocked out.
You were already out.
Please, someone brought us here. Put us to bed, and there's probably bacon sizzling and a plate of scrambled eggs waiting downstairs right this minute.
Ugh, I could use it.
Me too.
Hello?
Anybody home?
Good morning. Oh, no scrambled eggs.
They must have gone out. Probably expected us to sleep for a while.
Must be pretty casual types to go off and leave us sleeping up there.
Phone. At least I can find out where we are. Information 411?
I don't know. Just dial zero. Bob!
What do you make of that? It wasn't wired in.
Well, they probably didn't pay their bill.
It still ought to be wired in.
Well, we better leave them a note and offer to pay for the damage. Got a pencil?
Nope.
Must be one around here somewhere.
Weird.
Oh, my God. She's not a very good housekeeper. All the drawers are sticking. Bob, will you help me?
What?
Oh, what have you done now?
This drawer isn't real.
What?
Darn it.
What you need is some food. Just empty cartons. What? Artificial? This bread. It's stage bread. It's a prop. Bob, I don't like it here. Nothing's real. Bob, do you believe in ghosts?
No, but let's get out of here anyway. Bob and Millie Fraser. Average young New Yorkers who attended a party in the country last night and on the way home took a detour.
Most of us, on waking in the morning, know exactly where we are. The rooster or the alarm clock brings us out of sleep into the familiar sights, sounds, aromas of home and the comfort of a routine day ahead. Not so with our young friends. This will be a day like none they have ever spent, and they'll spend it in the Twilight Zone. Hey, kid! Oh, jeez. Kid, I guess he went on.
Well, what do we do now?
Well, whoever put us up for the night isn't home. Let's try one of the neighbors.
I wish I could remember how we got here. It reminds me of the Coney Island spook house.
Does it strike you it's just as spooky out here?
It's kind of quiet.
Not even a bird singing.
Well, maybe they're just being considerate of your splitting headache.
Quit needling.
Who's needling? If you'd been sober enough to drive, we might be home now instead of, well, wherever this is.
Hicksville.
It's bigger than that little town you were born in.
I at least had the sense to move to New York. How these yokels stand it, I'll never know.
Oh, you mean all these yokels standing around gawking at us?
You see any?
Not a soul.
That's the way it is in small towns. They peep from behind curtains. Give me the big city any day. At least there you know when you're being stared at.
Well, there's one citizen who makes no pretense about staring. Oh, look, it's a squirrel. Isn't he cute?
Oh, honey, come on.
Oh, I think he's tame. He's not the least bit afraid.
Big deal.
Come on, isn't he sweet?
Yeah, he's a real doll.
Oh, nice baby. Oh, oh!
What is it?
Oh, I just touched it and it fell over dead.
This thing's been dead for years. It's stuffed.
Why would anybody want to stuff a squirrel?
Might have been a pet.
That is no way to treat a pet, even a stuffed one. Leaving it out in the weather like this?
Mill, don't ask me to figure out why anybody does anything in this hick town.
Well, you don't have to hurt their feelings. They'll hear you. Where are you going?
Up there to that house.
For what?
First, I'd like to find out where we are. Second, I'd like to use their phone. And third, I'd like to beg, buy, borrow, or steal an aspirin.
I wish I had a comb.
What did you do with it?
It was in my purse.
And where's that?
I guess I left it at the party.
Sounds like you were a little under the influence yourself.
Yeah, at least I was able to drive. You don't have to break the door down.
Will you quit criticizing me?
I am not criticizing. I just want to go home.
And just how do you suggest we get there?
I don't know. I just don't like this place. I don't know how we got here, and nobody lands at the door. Bob, I'm frightened.
Don't get all female and fluttery on me.
Well, it's one way to get help. Will someone help us, please? Help? Somebody, help! We're lost here, and we need you. Excuse me, is there anybody there? Can anybody hear us? Please, won't one of you help us? What was that?
Someone laughing.
That's that child we heard before.
At least the town's not deserted. Could be they're all in one place, a town meeting or something like that.
On a Sunday morning?
Especially on a Sunday morning. That's where everybody is. They've gone to church.
Well, we can't just walk in.
Oh, watch me.
What'll you tell them?
I'll tell them I'm tired of their creepy little town and I'll pay anybody, anything he asks, to get us to a train or a bus that'll get us back to civilization.
Awfully quiet.
Maybe they're praying.
We'd better wait.
Here's the church, and there's the steeple. Open the door, and nobody.
Well, what now?
Oh, here's a bell rope. This'll bring them.
What are you going to do?
Ring the church bell. It's the oldest distress signal in the books. Hey, look outside. See if anybody's coming.
Nobody's coming, Bob.
Where'd everybody go?
There isn't anybody. It's just us.
Oh, come on.
No, there's not a person, not a living thing in this town, and yet...
What?
Well, we're being watched.
Millie.
No, I know when I'm being watched.
Now you're getting delusions.
Oh, was that a delusion?
I'm going to find that kid. Hey, kid. Where are you? Come on, don't hide. Whoever you are, come out and talk to us. All right, we are being watched. It's probably a whopping case of xenophobia.
Oh, my God, that sounds dreadful. What is that?
Fear or distrust of strangers. It's common in these little one-horse towns. There are probably half a dozen people watching us from their living room windows right this minute.
Gives me goose pimples. Ugh. What a time to be without a handkerchief.
Why?
Shasta daisies. I'm allergic to them. Don't you remember when I took all those tests?
Yeah.
Ugh, look at those things. I'm sure they're Shastas. I used to buy bunches of them and sneeze all the way home. Bob?
Yeah?
These flowers aren't real. They're artificial.
Lots of people
all of
do
them.
That. They dress up their flower beds with artificial
no,
flowers.
I know. But nothing in this town is real. That house we slept in, the child we can't find, a stuffed squirrel? Show me one thing in this place that's real.
That tree is real.
It's real!
What did you expect?
I don't know, but I think I would have lost my grip if one more thing here turned out to be artificial. Oh, tree, I love you.
What the?
Oh, my good. Get me out of here!
Honey, there's bound to be some explanation.
I'd like to know what that could be.
You just calm down here.
Where are we? Where on earth are we?
Looks like Main Street to me. A bank? A shop? Is anyone here? Can anyone hear me?
Don't try anymore. Just keep walking till we get out of this nightmare.
Wait. Music, it's coming from that shop.
Bob, don't go in.
Why not?
You don't know what's in there.
I know that something has to start that music box.
I don't want to know. I just want to get away from here.
Well, I want to know. Hello? Anybody here?
Bob, please, come on.
The music box didn't start all by itself.
It could have. Or footsteps could have jarred it into starting or something. It was too tightly wound. We came along, our footsteps jolted into starting, I don't know.
But somebody had to wind it.
Oh, right, somebody wound it. But they aren't here anymore, there's nobody here but us, and these are stage props.
Say that again.
What again?
Stage props. That's where we are.
On a stage?
No, on an old movie lot. There are two or three of them in the Bronx. We're probably 10 minutes from the heart of New York City.
I'll race you home.
You got a deal. Let's go this way. Ah, look. A car and someone's in it. Boy, am I glad to see you. We've been wandering around here all morning and you're the first person...
Bob! Oh my... It's a mannequin! Jeez,
I don't know
whiz.
What it is. Maybe a trick? Maybe a joke? Is somebody watching us? Are you watching us there behind one of those windows? Are you testing us? Taking notes to see how much of this we could take before we turn into blabbering idiots? Is this some kind of joke?
Bob, please don't try to find out anything more. Let's just keep going.
Honey, we're gonna get out of here and fast. Look at that! The keys are in the ignition.
Do you think it's all right?
You want to get out of here, don't you? So long, Spooksville. Come on. Come on, let's go.
Oh, you're going to flood the motor. Stop.
You want to drive? You're the one that drove us into this nut house in the first place. Big joke. Look, it's empty. There isn't any motor. There's no engine in this thing. Did you hear what I said? Isn't that a howl? No motor. God, what have I done now, honey?
I didn't drive us into this place.
I'm sorry I said that. It's all my fault for getting too tight to drive.
I still didn't drive us here.
You don't remember anymore anything that happened, how we got here?
Only what I told you. I was driving along just above Riverdale. You were asleep in the back seat. Something like a shadow just seemed to envelop the car, and that's all I remember. I guess I fainted.
Or crashed.
All right, maybe I did crash. That would explain everything, wouldn't it?
Not to me.
I crashed the car. Maybe we're dead. Maybe this place is hell.
Did you ever hear of a freight train in hell?
Probably doesn't stop here.
Then we'll catch the next one. Come on, let's find the station. Hey. There she comes. It's slowing down, honey. We're going home.
Hello, where have you been, you great big beautiful train? Isn't that a beautiful train?
That's the most beautiful train I ever saw.
Isn't it a gorgeous train?
Most gorgeous train I ever rode.
Oh, what about the tickets?
We'll pay the conductor. Hey, where do you want to sit?
Anywhere. Looks like we've got the whole car to ourselves. Look, the name on the little town is Centerville.
Never heard of it.
Well, I hope we never hear of it again.
What a nutty little town.
I still wonder how we got there.
Why don't you admit it? You did have a few drinks at the party, didn't you?
Well, one or two.
Somewhere along the road, your drinks caught up with you. You got lost and ended up in Centerville.
I guess it's the kind of screwball thing I would do. How do you put up with me?
I guess I've just got a weakness for screwballs.
Well, you've sure got one. It wasn't all that frightening back there. It's just that whenever somebody goes boo, I jump a foot.
Boo.
Oh, you.
Wait till I get to the office. I can see old Mr. Peabody now. Fraser, we're a team here. If one member of the team lets us down, then the whole organization suffers.
No. Look at the sign.
Maybe it's not the same Centerville.
It's the same one. There is not a soul on the street. Nothing moving. Nothing real. How could we have gotten back to here?
We went in a circle. Come on.
I'm not going back.
Not back. We're going to get to that main street, and this time we're going to keep walking. Let's try right this time.
Let's run.
Could you?
I could gallop if it would get us out of here faster.
Better save your strength. Might be a long road ahead.
We've still got a few hours of daylight. The sun should still be out for...
What the...
Honey,
look up!
No, Doc! Get away!
Oh my
Becca!
God.
What is that? What is that
I don't
thing?
Know! I don't know! Okay, it's gone.
Doc, it's gone, honey.
It's gone. Jack!
Oh my... It's back! It's back!
Get low!
No, don't go near the door! Near the door!
Be careful with your pets, dear. Daddy brought them all the way from Earth.
Can't I play with them, Mommy?
After lunch, dear. Right now, put them back in their cage.
Okay, back you go.
The moral of what you've just seen is clear. If you drink, don't drive. And if your wife has had a couple, she shouldn't drive either. You both just might wake up with a whale of a headache in a deserted village in the Twilight Zone.
And finally, Pamela's Voice by Rod Serling, read by Erica Slater.
It had been an absolutely smashing day, begun auspiciously with his favorite Eggs Benedict breakfast, which he'd prepared himself, and then washed down with a dainty, exquisite Pinot. He had tiptoed quietly from the house for a brisk and invigorating walk in the clear April morning, and then returned before Pamela had awakened. Then he had strung the piano wire across the third step from the top of the stairway, testing it for strength and tautness. Following that, he'd fixed himself a spot of Irish coffee in the study and sat patiently in his favourite leather chair, facing the bay window that offered such a delightful view of the incredibly beautiful morning. At promptly 11 o'clock, the bell from Pamela's bedroom began to jangle furiously. He had smiled, picturing her in her hairnet, mudpack, chinstrap, and all the other nocturnal devices Pamela used to give battle to encroaching age. He sipped at his coffee, hearing the groaning wheeze of the mattress as she left the bed, and then her heavy footsteps to the door, followed by her shrill voice calling his name as she came out onto the upper landing. "Jonathan? Jonathan, are you down there? Jonathan, why aren't you answering my—" From the study, he heard first her surprised gasp and then her throttled scream. Close behind was a loud thump and then more thumps as Pamela came somersaulting down the stairs, her heavy body picking up momentum, until she finished her journey on the hard oak floor at the foot of the stairs. Jonathan came out of the study to find her sitting upright against the wall in a welter of silk bathrobe and hanging hairnet, directly under the severe-looking portrait of her great-grandfather. Her broken neck, rooster-style, left her shoulder blades at an impossible angle, and when Jonathan gently lifted up her head, her still-opened eyes, smudged with mascara, glared at him with silent fury under the arched, plucked eyebrows. He had gazed into the dead-horse face of his wife through the cracks of the mud-pack and the various creams, and noted that in death, as in life, Pamela was perhaps the ugliest woman on the face of the earth. But it was odd, he thought, as he walked to the phone to perform the meaningless ritual of calling a doctor, that even in death her mouth was open. there was that yawning cavern with the big yellow teeth, frozen in its accustomed position, parted and agape. He could imagine what was clogged up by the sudden detour in her windpipe. Her daily epithets, criticisms, whinings, and multiple angers precipitously cut off by Jonathan's piano wire. The burnished mahogany casket reflected the four tall candles, as well as the tiers of flowers and wreaths placed around it. And Jonathan, his spare trim little frame housed impeccably in a silk smoking jacket, sat in his leather chair across the room looking at it. He placed a long cigarette in a holder. He lit it, started to put the match into an ashtray, and then, as if reminded by the casket, flipped the match onto the carpet. He then tapped the ashes off his cigarette to land at his feet and leaned back luxuriously. Among the myriad things that Pamela had disapproved of, smoking was the top of the list. And dropping ashes on the carpet she had placed in the same category as child-beating and infidelity. But there were many things, Jonathan reflected, that Pamela disapproved of. The candles, Jonathan noted, made the Victorian room brighter than it had ever been. Pamela had lectured him incessantly about wasting electricity. She would walk from room to room turning off light switches. "When not in use, turn off the juice," she would say. And then she would move into whatever room Jonathan was in and sniff the air. "Have you been smoking, Jonathan?" she would always ask. "Tobacco is one of the most miserable poisons extant. Quite apart from what it does to the body, it fouls the air permanently." Jonathan smiled as he reflected. Pamela had never known what permanently meant until she'd been placed in the box across the room. Pamela had really not known much of anything except how to rage, persecute, complain, and vilify. Jonathan had wished for her death for the first 5 years, desperately prayed for it the next five, and actively planned it for the last five. 15 years, he thought to himself, 15 years with Pamela's mouth, that working, smacking, perpetually moving noise box that kept opening and shutting as if on an oiled hinge, giving him no peace, no silence, no escape. He rose from the chair, dusted some ashes off the lapel of his smoking jacket, and walked over to a small cabinet. From it he took a bottle of wine that had been formerly hidden in the cellar. He squinted at its label. A light-bodied claret from 1923, which, Jonathan reflected again, had been a fair year. He carried the bottle over to the chair, and in the process passed Pamela sitting on the sofa. He nodded affably towards her, and then stopped in his track, as a glacier rose from his feet and took a freezing journey up to his brain. "Pamela? Pamela sitting on the sofa?" He blinked, swallowed, and turned very slowly to look again toward the sofa. Pamela sat there, slightly transparent and very ghost-like. But she sat there. And there was nothing ephemeral in the voice. It was Pamela's shrill, grating, enveloping, "Nothing better to do tonight, Jonathan? Just stand there like a bump on a log?" Jonathan blinked again instead. "Look hard enough and you'll see me. You're blind as a bat, Jonathan." Jonathan checked the bottle in his hand to see if perhaps he'd already drunk from it. It was still corked and full. He took a deep breath. "Pamela, is that your voice?" The spectre on the sofa seemed to grow more solid. "Whose voice were you expecting, you idiot? Who else's voice could it possibly be? And don't stand there gaping like an owl." Jonathan sat down in his favourite chair. Of course it was Pamela. No one else could fire off that many tired metaphors per minute, and no one's voice could sound like fingernails across a blackboard like Pamela's. He carefully put the bottle aside, then forced himself to look directly at Pamela. Yes, it was definitely Pamela. The severe, hating eyes, the long, tallow-coloured face, the gaping, open mouth. "Surprised?" Pamela asked. "At what?" The figure on the sofa shrugged. "And by being here?" Jonathan leaned back in the chair. He felt no fear at all. Pamela, the dead apparition, seemed infinitely less menacing than Pamela, that shrewish piano-legged bane of 15 endless years. "Hardly surprised," he said mildly. "In life, my dear Pamela, you arrived every place uninvited. You and that hyena-mating voice of yours." She seemed totally materialized now and sat as she had always sat, hunched forwards, clenched fists, an open mouth twisted like the bent mouthpiece of a bugle. "Tell me, Pamela," he said, "how are things up there? Keeping you occupied, are they? Keeping you contented? Are there lives, or rather, afterlives you can destroy with gossip? Reputations you can filthy up with your dark little suspicions and that kitchen-knife tongue of yours?" He laughed. "Incredible, really incredible. It never occurred to me, Pamela." He pointed at her. "You're probably not even up there. Most likely you're..." He stopped, pointing a finger at the floor. "Crazy as a loon," Pamela said. "I'm neither, Jonathan. I'm right here. I've not left, though you did your level best to get me out of the way." Jonathan looked over at the casket and smiled. "Pamela," he said, "you are out of the way. Resilient you were, but altogether mortal. And being mortal, my dear, a broken neck did you in nicely." He leaned forward in the chair. "Was it painful? I mean, when you landed at the foot of the stairs. Hurt much, did it?" "Not a particle," Pamela said icily. "Oh, pity." Jonathan shook his head a little forlornly. "That rather takes the fun out of it. I'd hoped the discomfort would be somewhat prolonged. You know, tit for tat. My 15-odd years of marital agony against at least a few minutes of some pronounced pain of your own. A real pity, Pamela." Pamela rose from the surface. "You had it rough, did you?" she screeched at him. "You meandering tomcat, you! Why, I could have had the pick of any man in town. My daddy, God rest his soul, had to bar the doors to keep the swains from forcing their way in." Jonathan looked up at the ceiling and laughed. "The swains," he roared. "The swains, indeed. My God, Pamela, there weren't swains. They were a two-platoon system of fortune hunters and hungry gigolos." "So you say." "Because it's the truth. Without your big daddy's bank account, you couldn't have gotten a proposal in an all-male penal colony. You couldn't have even gotten an indecent proposition." "Now you listen to me, Jonathan," her shrill voice just as always enveloped the room. Jonathan simply turned away and lit another cigarette. "I have listened to you, Pamela," he said. "For over 15 years I have listened to you to the point of a bleeding ulcer, 2 ruptured eardrums, and a permanent migraine." With this he uncorked the wine bottle and then started to carry it back over to the chest for a glass. Inexplicably, Pamela was standing right in front of him. He hadn't seen her move. She just appeared as if transported from her former place to a point in front of the chest, directly in Jonathan's path. He stopped and drew away from her waggling finger. "You listen to me, Jonathan," she said, "and you keep listening because I intend to keep right on talking." Jonathan shrugged, turned, and retreated back to his chair. Once again he found Pamela standing in front of him, blocking him. "You were a swine as a husband." Her voice, a constant perpetual siren, shrilled at him, and he found himself staring at that omniscient cave that kept opening and closing. "You were a rotter as a companion, a faithless fancy Dan with all the morals of a Bowery wino." Then something exploded inside of him. That mouth of hers, that voice of hers, clawed a hole in his restraint, and through it poured all the rage, all the frustration, all the mountainous hatred he had managed to throttle over the miserable decade and a half. "You bloody bitch, you," he screamed at her. "Close that big flapping mouth of yours. You think I've risked an electric chair just to suffer more of you? That suet pudding bodding of yours, well, that's one thing. But that voice of yours, Pamela, that voice, that untuned trombone screech that fills the room every time you air your tonsils. It flowed out of him, the hot, bubbling waves of venom so long pent up. That's what made me do it, Pamela. That cacophony of noise, that off-key lunch whistle, that cracked calliope that woke me in the morning and shrieked at me throughout the day and battered my head at night. He held out a fist in front of her face. That's why I murdered you, Pamela, so I wouldn't have to listen to that voice of yours. Pamela's laughter filled the room and made him wince. Well, now, she said, fancy that. Poor, sensitive man with the delicate ears didn't care for the sound of my voice. She sauntered back over to the sofa and sat down. What do you suppose you're listening to now, Jonathan? She asked. Dead, I may be, but what is it you're listening to? Jonathan moved over to the casket and leaned against it, lighting a cigarette. What am I listening to? He repeated. He tapped his forehead. My imagination, that's what I'm listening to. I'm listening, Pamela, to a fantasy. I'm looking at a spectre. You, that dumpy, flabby carcass of yours, that pulsating and perpetual nagging. I'm imagining it. He let the fingers of one hand move across the polished surface of the casket. Do you recall what Scrooge said to the ghost of Marley? You may be an undigested bit of beef, a blot of mustard, a crumb of cheese, a fragment of underdone potato. There is more gravy than grave about you. Understand, Pamela, you're very likely part of my eggs Benedict. Simply a case of stereophonic indigestion. He smiled, tapped the side of the casket, and then crooked a finger at her. Why fight it, Pamela? It's beddy by time. Permanent beddy by time. He looked at his watch. They'll be coming for you soon. Pamela's voice sounded puzzled. Who will? Why, the funeral director and his minions, of course. We're going to convey you to the cemetery. Pamela stared at him. How's that again, Jonathan? Jonathan's anger fizzled out like a spent firecracker. His voice was patient. The cemetery, my dear. The repository of the deceased. The tomb, the vault, the crypt, the resting place, the ossuary. Dig? Boot Hill, baby. Pamela sighed. I swear, Jonathan, you're still the most absent-minded man I've ever met. Absent-minded as a professor. I am, he said, pointing to himself. Don't you remember? You buried me months ago. Jonathan blinked at her. I did what? He asked. A funny feeling of disorientation. I fell down the stairs on the 17th of April. My funeral was on the 19th, and this is August. Again he blinked at her and tried to remember. How could it be August? The whole thing had happened just that morning. Or had it? He suddenly realized that he was unable to piece together the chronology of the day. He remembered his walk and the eggs Benedict and the piano wire. But that was this morning. Or another day. Or when was it? August, he repeated. August, she answered in an unusually soft voice. He stared at her for a long moment, took a few steps halfway across the room towards her, and then stopped and looked over his shoulder at the casket, jerking his thumb at it. And that? He asked, whispering. He didn't wait for her reply. He turned and walked back over to the casket, feeling the anchor-chain weight of premonition, not wanting to look but compelled to look even so. Pamela folded her arms in front of her. When she spoke, her voice zoomed up to its normal high-pitched shattering decibel level. "Oh, you've only yourself to blame," she bugled out triumphantly. "It's no more than you deserve for so excessively celebrating my demise." Jonathan peered into the casket. The cigarette in its holder fell to the floor. Lying there on tufted velvet was himself. Hands folded, in peaceful repose. Pamela's voice formed an obbligato to the silent moment. All that rich food, she scolded. Those late hours, the alcoholic spirits. If I've told you once, I've told you 100 times, Jonathan. You were constitutionally unsuited for the life of indecency and bacchanalian self-indulgence. Jonathan stood there, rooted, staring in numb disbelief at his own waxen face in the casket. He was only barely conscious of the fractious screech that came from across the room. Would you listen to me, Jonathan? Of course not. Like all the other sound advice I offered you down the years, you ungratefully ignored it, and don't think I don't know why you married me, you fortune-hunted finagler. You married me for my money, my position, my family, this house. Jonathan tore his gaze away from the corpse and turned back. Pamela, it isn't just you, it's also... Pamela filled it in for him. You, Jonathan, that's correct. The word is ghost. I reject that, he announced in a slightly quavering voice, as palpably impossible. I reject you, Pamela, because when one dies, one either goes up there, and he pointed to the ceiling, or down there, and he pointed to the floor. You're as right as rain, Jonathan, Pamela said, right as rain, and in heaven you can do anything you want. Now, my being a social woman, an extrovert, you might say, a person who enjoys communicating, well, I spend the rest of my eternity talking. And you, Jonathan, you pusher of wives down staircases, while I talk through eternity, you'll listen. Again, he found himself staring at her mouth. Eternity, he whispered. He pointed to himself. Me? He pointed to her. Listening to you? Someplace deep in him accepted. He knew it was no nightmare, at least it was no sleeping nightmare. This nightmare lived and breathed and existed. He cleared his throat. That's grossly unfair, Pamela, he announced. You just said that in heaven one can do anything one wishes. Pamela's beady lizard eyes shone with triumphant pleasure. In heaven, Jonathan, indeed. But I'm afraid the organization to which you've been assigned is not quite so accommodating. And he knew. Oh, yes, indeed, he knew. He remembered his death then as he remembered hers. Eternity was tailored for the individual. And as he watched her mouth move and heard the staccato, ceaseless, remorseless, unending shrillness of her voice, he knew all about his eternity. "Now, what was I saying?" Pamela asked. "Oh, yes, as I was commenting before, Jonathan, just before you pushed me down those stairs, it's always been my feeling that you can judge a man by the way he listens." Jonathan stood there helplessly, hopelessly. His ears began to twitch and burn. His head began to ache. And still Pamela's voice continued. Not the way a man dresses, Jonathan. Mind you, that's important. It's the way a man listens. Now, if a man is responsive, if he's attentive, if a man really has an interest in what you're saying... The grandfather clock in the corner of the room ticked away in perfect cadence to Pamela's voice. Tick, tick, tick. And, Jonathan, I want to discuss something else with you. Tick, tick, tick. This cigarette-smoking thing. You know that tobacco is a miserable poison and it fouls up the air. Tick, tick, tick. And another thing, Jonathan. Tick, tick, tick. The wave of noise smashed over his brain like pounding surf. He fell to wetness and looked down at the tears on his transparent hands. There were two things he knew for certain. Ghosts could cry. Now tell me, Jonathan. And ghosts could hear. The grandfather clock and Pamela's voice went on and on and on.
We hope you've enjoyed our presentation of The Twilight Zone, produced and directed by Catherine Thornton and Erica Slater. Tune in next time for Radioactive Theater, a production of Audio Journal.